He's a friend. Russ Baker joins us. Russ, good morning, and welcome back to Denver, Colorado, 710 KNUS.
Good morning. Great to be here.
So when they call them, they release 28 pages. And by the way, I should have asked you to do this. Do a quick bio so people know who you are if they've not heard you before.
Sure. I'm an investigative journalist. I am the author of a book called Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. It's a book I spent 5 years on trying to do investigative historical research on the background to the rise of the Bush family and from Selden Cheney and the whole complex related to it. That book came out a number of years ago, and it's still selling very, very well because it explains a lot about what is going on today in our country. I'm also the founder of a nonprofit news organization called Who, What, Why, whowhatwhy.org, and we specialize in doing reporting on stories or on angles that the media generally do not cover.
Recently, I've read two books, and I thought quite a bit of you. Have you read Assassin's Gate?
I have not.
Please. Have you read The Rise of the Vulcans?
No, I have to tell you what my problem is.
Okay.
It's a fundamental problem. I am working on another book right now about the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Okay.
And I have on my shelves something like 300 books on that subject alone. And I've started to use this expression, which is either you read books or you write them.
Yeah. No,
I don't really mean that, but there literally are so many good books coming out so fast, I simply don't know how to process all of it. And so believe it or not, I rely on you and a whole network of other people to direct me to what they think are the key revelations from some of these things. And then that's how I'm able to stitch so much stuff together.
They are companions to you. You know, I think of books as companion books. And The Rise of the Vulcans is such a damning book. And Assassin's Gate is a further damning book. But in 2002, George W. Bush suppresses an entire chapter of the Congressional Joint Inquiry that was dubbed the 9/11 Commission Report. And the chapter that focused on the details about the financing of 9/11. And they made all these promises to declassify those pages, and Barack Obama maintained suppression. We've talked about it. We were lucky enough to have Senator Graham on, numbers of people on, who spoke about this. Well, I was out of the country, and the 28 pages dropped. I came home, and in fact, those recently released 28 pages, the inquiry into the 9/11 attacks, when you read them, what do you see?
Well, first of all, you see two things. Number one, you see significant redactions.
Again.
So
yes.
We're talking about redactions on a redaction.
Yes.
And that's significant, obviously, because, you know, and I've had the opportunity to speak to Senator Graham, and we talked about, one of the things we talked about, and we wrote an article about this on Who or Why, was the astonishing fact that his continued efforts over the years to get these pages released and more importantly to try to get the country to follow up on what happened and what this all means, that he himself, this is a former governor of Florida, former U.S. Senator from Florida, former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that he tells this astonishing story where he arrived in Washington at the airport and was surprised to be met by an FBI agent. He just didn't follow him. They took him to an unmarked room, and in there he was confronted by what he described as a very, very senior FBI official. Mm-hmm. You can imagine that was either the director or the number two person, who then basically told him to stop sticking his nose into these affairs.
Yes.
Now, to me, in the history of this country, that is a significant event.
No, I agree. I mean, I think Senator Graham hung the moon. He has been so accessible to us. When I got onto the story, he would never once said, no, I won't do your show. He was as open and as honest as he could be. When he appeared on 60 Minutes, it really was a really significant moment. So when I got home, when everything settled down, I went on the internet, and the first thing that struck me is we have not, even though the claim is we've released the 28 pages, they have not. Again, the redactions continue, and I mean, it's despicable. It is absolutely despicable, and the Bush family again dances away. Dick Cheney dances away. I watch these people. Rumsfeld dances away. Wolfowitz dances away. But you see the connections principally between what I'm able to read is Prince Bandar bin Sultan and other members of the royal family financed and actively aided the hijackers prior and right up to the day of 9/11. Am I reading that one right?
Well, you know, I think so. I have a sort of unusual approach to the way that I do investigative journalism, and I think that is true for our organization, Who, What, Why, as well. We realize that we inhabit a hall of mirrors, and so we look at things that we see, and we wonder. We know what we see is important, but we're not always sure what to make of it. And so what you say appears to be absolutely correct. I always do a little bit of chess playing on these things. I always try to kind of play them out, and I try to put myself in the shoes of the various key figures. So one of the things I try to think about is try to imagine what was going through various people's minds, because certainly if I were Prince Bandar or any of these other guys, and I realized that this was going to play out this way, I can't imagine that he, with hindsight, would see this as favorable for himself.
No.
Which then raises all kinds of interesting questions. I mean, I think they certainly knew these people, and they were giving funding, and this is very, very important, as you point out. We can talk a little bit about the particular individuals who are described in this congressional report. And by the way, let me do this. I want to this point. Let's hold that point for a second. And if it's okay, Peter, let's go back a second and just kind of frame this for folks who may not be all that familiar with it. After 9/11, there actually were two different inquiries, or if you want to call them inquiries. One was mandated by Congress, and it was the joint inquiry that you're talking about. And it included the leading members from the Democratic Republican Party of the Senate and House Intelligence
Committee. And it's also important to remind people that George Bush and Dick Cheney did not want this report done.
Well, that's right. That's right. And they didn't want the congressional report done. And then they created their own their so-called official 9/11 inquiry, where again had... You know, it was a little bit of a mirror. So you had, you know, instead of senators and House members, you had some former senators and House members. And then you had Philip Zelikow, yep, who was the executive director of the commission. And, you know, because I'm working on a book now about the Kennedy assassination, I'm very, very interested in commissions. I've been taking quite a close look at the Warren Commission, which similarly was, you know, appointed by a president and was supposed to get to the bottom of things, but very clearly had a mandate to wrap things up. They didn't want to, but they couldn't, even if they wanted to.
Oh, indeed.
And it's interesting, Peter, because when you read the transcripts and you read some of the letters and the notes and things, even those people who understood that their job, like a lot of these corporate inquiries where, you know, a corporation says we're going to investigate ourselves, was just to give them a clean bill of health and obfuscate and try to not make things worse, but also make it appear as if they had looked into things and cleaned things up. In all these inquiries, usually there are people who feel bad about being stooges, and so they struggle to try to do something. And in the case of the official 9/11 inquiry, there was at least one investigator, and probably more, who tried to pursue, say, this Saudi funding angle, and were slapped down. Yeah. So we know that there's even the commissioners themselves on the if you want to say, somewhat less potent official 9/11 inquiry. Even they complained about it. And it's a very interesting quote former Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska. And he talks about how they weren't allowed to encourage these. Now, what happened, just to kind of get back to the history, so you had the report from the congressional inquiry where that was released with all of these pages, about 28 to 29 pages redacted. And then you had the other inquiry, the 9/11 Commission, so-called 9/11 Commission. And the reports that were publicized were rather bland, and they both said things to the effect of, the Saudi government as an entity or any major officials, and blah, 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 had anything to do with this stuff, and, the U.S. government as a whole, nor any, blah, 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 and it's all lawyers' language, through a whole program parsing that kind of a thing. But in any case, many years passed. Now, an event took place there were little bits here and there that came out in the news about connections between, and I know you've done many shows on this, but connections between the alleged hijackers and various individuals, particularly in California, where there were interactions between them. And of course, this goes to the heart of what the Congressional Joint Inquiry looked at.
But if I could pause so I could reset. If you're just joining us, it is 16 after the hour. It's going to be another hot day in Denver. While I was away, the so-called 28 pages dropped, but it wasn't what you expected. The 28 pages of the 9/11 Commission, and it really isn't anything you can say this is new, because once again, the black pen is used. And so you can see a clearer picture, but you can't see this. You can't read what I believe to be true, and I'm using words like believe. Russ Baker is our guest. I'm a big fan of his work. If you listen to people like Walter Jones, who's a Republican from North Carolina, and the man that we both just think hung the moon, Senator Bob Graham, and if you listen to what these men say who actually read the 28 pages, you cannot, neither can I. And what's interesting is this, there's nothing to see here now, position that's been staked out by big media and politicians that somehow this entire 28 pages is now available for you to read. It's not. And, people, and I'm a big fan of Russ's work, and people have always liked the terms shadow government. And Bandar Bush, and that's the name that Barbara Bush gave Prince Bandar, but it goes back to one of the most significant guys, is Omar al-Bayoumi. And he was that intelligence operator. He had a no-show job, and he's the guy that picked up the first two murderers when they got here. And now the evidence is overwhelming that Bandar's wife was taking care of el-Hamzi and el-Midar, who are the first two to arrive in the United States. And the other fellow, al-Bayoumi, got them apartments. He co-signed a rental agreement. He chauffeured them around. He helped them obtain information on flight schools. Now, that's pretty damning. But, of course, Bandar, from my reading, and I turn it back to you, is practically the star of these 28 pages. And it's no wonder George Bush, who called him Bandar Bush, his mother called him Bandar Bush, they had close ties to him. They fought so hard to keep the secret. Plus, as the wise guys have said, December the 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, so FDR invades Mexico. This shows the total lies of the invasion of Iraq. So there's a lot at stake here, Russ, is there not?
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, Prince Bandar, he was such an important guy. Some of the listeners may remember him, the picture of him sitting on the White House balcony with George W. Bush.
Smoking cigars.
And this guy really was a smooth, smooth fellow who played a major role. Went back to Saudi Arabia where he was helping lead their intelligence operation. He has continued to move around in absolutely critical positions. And so, as you say, I mean, the fact that he, that his wife and so forth were providing funding, there was a, I don't know if you mentioned this, he personally wrote a $5,000 check that was to one of these people. And, you know, they call them alleged intelligence officers because it's virtually impossible to prove those relationships because you're not going to see an employment letter or, you know, they're not carrying an ID card or something. But it's pretty clear, I think, to anyone, and the way you sketched it out, you did a good job of that, you know, that if you look at all this pretty clearly, I mean, they were in and out of the embassies. There were, you know, informants who they spoke to. One of them sort of bragged that he did more than the other one in enabling hijackers. I mean, in a court of law, this would be dispositive. So, you know, it's very, very significant. And so getting back to this sequence here, so this report is suppressed. Public is told, well, there's really nothing to see here, as you point out. And then finally, several weeks ago, I wonder if they released it because you were away.
They chose me, right?
Yeah. But in any case, they released it just as Congress was adjourning to go away for 7 weeks. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is a famous old trick. You dump something important
on Friday,
the beginning of a weekend.
Dump it on Friday.
Can't wait to get away. Yeah. And, of course, they're all getting away, so they're not even around.
Let me do this. I just looked up. I need to take a turnaround, Russ. Please hang on. Russ Baker's with us. Also coming on the show, Jack Cashill, Casper Stockham's in studio. But this is a significant story of what the Bush administration did. And now we're beginning to know the truth. And by the way, and Russ and I will have a conversation about it, but El Turkey, the guy that we spent so much time, and John Southers flew to Saudi Arabia to tell the then king and the El Turkey family about his treatment, he is in these pages. I mean, this goes steep and deep. All right, readiness is the key. Go make a 10-minute phone call. You can make that call for somebody if you wish. 303-827-4837. 303-827-4837. GoSober.org is the website. You can look at the website on, you know, take a look, www.GoSober.org. The weather, 95, the high, 97 on Wednesday, Thursday, 95 degrees. The one and only Russ Baker is with us, whowhatwhy.org. I'm a big fan. I've read many of his books. He's got one coming, he just said, on the Kennedys, and I can't wait for that one. His book on the Bush family is a home run, and we have spoken quite a bit over the years about the suppression of the entire chapter of the Congressional Joint Inquiry on the 9/11 report, the so-called 28 pages. I was gone, and the 28 pages came down, and I went on the Internet, and they're just simply blacked-out pen lines again. And so trying to read through the lines, maybe one or two things became a little more clear. But by and large, I think it's reasonable for us to assume that what this is an indictment of the Saudi government. It shows the Saudi government, including top officials such as then-Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Bandar bin Salman, and other members of the royal family, financed and actively aided the hijackers prior to 9/11. But what's so damning about this is, and this is from other readings, that when it came time for the commissioners to speak with George Bush, the only way that he and Bush would speak was he and Cheney would speak together. And I think Cheney's calling these shots. I don't think Bush is smart enough. That the investigators would have to come to the White House. The other condition was there was a time limit. The other condition is they would not go under oath. And the other condition was they would only agree to be interviewed together. And so it's almost like the Ramses, where John and Patsy are never separated and asked questions. And so W sat there, and I sort of vision him sitting like Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy sitting on Edgar's knee answering questions. And then after it was said and done, then the Bush administration, read here George Bush himself or Dick Cheney or both, and then suppressed those 28 pages. So Walter Jones, who was the chief sponsor, and he's been on the radio show, I'm a huge fan, he's Republican from North Carolina. And by the way, when you hear him speak, Russ, he'll tell you, the Republican Party came into North Carolina and tried to unseat him This was under W. And so now we come to here. So what do we do? What do you want to say?
Well, first of all, and we should talk about what can one do, but if we have the time, I'd like to just go
We have the time. We have the time.
I'd like to go back to another element of the story. First of all, for anyone who may just be tuning in, if you want to get up to speed on the newly released, yet still redacted, previously redacted pages of this very, very important congressional 9/11 inquiry with the information about the relationship between the Saudi government and the 9/11 hijackers, we ran a piece on our site, whowhatwhy.org, about a week ago by one of our editors, a guy named Jeff Clyburn. Shout out to him. He did a great job. It's called Official 9/11 Narrative on Life Support. And I think he does a very good job of summing up an extremely complex subject, and particularly providing some context to this release. So you may want to take a look at that. In any case, there's another piece of this story, and this one is one that we at Who, What, Why investigated some years ago. We continue to bring up. And this is ties also going back to the Saudi royal family, but it comes from Graham's own home state of Florida, where a Saudi family living in a gated community, a wealthy family, was identified as having interacted directly with several of the alleged 9/11 hijackers, and then when they were in the same area where they were trained, we believe that their son, the son of this family, himself trained to fly at the same installation as several of the hijackers. That family disappeared. Left their house.
That's right.
In the days before,
there was food on. Wasn't there? The car was in the garage, and there was food, and I mean, they just fled.
Yeah, they didn't move. This was not a planned thing. They literally took off like somebody had told them, "Get the heck out while you can," and they just took off. I mean, there was everything still there, and except they grabbed the computer and a few other interesting things, and they split.
That's right.
And they never lived there again. Now, that was reported. The FBI belatedly went in to investigate that, and there was a report, an internal investigative report produced that was for the FBI that was quite damning. When that, years and years and years later, when that came out, the FBI actually disowned its own investigative agent and said basically that he had made this up. Now, what's interesting about this house and this family is that our group, whowhatwhy.org, we traced the man who owned the house, head of a prominent Saudi company, a very big company back there, and with homes in Washington, D.C., and down there and so on, that he works directly. He's the CEO of a company whose chairman was the person who went on. Prince Salman. Now, later, Prince Salman becomes the king of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is that a family directly implicated to a house where they're hosting the hijackers goes on to run the entire country. And so, you know, the fact that this doesn't come up, this is a separate piece from the interactions that we've been talking about here, where on the West Coast primarily we see what appear to be Saudi intelligence agents directly reporting in and taking funding from the Saudi royal family and then interacting with them, as you said, helping, you know, meeting the hijackers at the airport, getting them set up. I mean, you put those two things together, and as you raised this question to me earlier, I mean, doesn't this look like the Saudi government is you know, running and planning and financing all the, it certainly looks like that.
Hmm.
You know, it totally looks like that. And of course, as I said, because I see these things as potentially being more complicated, there are other possibilities, such as they themselves may have been misled as to what was afoot and who these people were and what they were going to do, which in a way makes sense also, because I don't think Bandar or any of these others would want to be implicated as they have been, because it ruins their lives too. And so this then, but it doesn't make any of this less important. It makes it more important, because then of course that raises the question, what could have been going on here that would like flypaper, tie all of these people into the most shocking events probably in the world over the course of, what, a century. You know, what could that all be about? And so I think that's, in a way, the next piece of this this puzzle project, to try to figure out, and assuming that this is all correct, that we can agree the evidence, preponderance of evidence, is that the Saudis were brought into contact with these people and funded them, raises the question then, did they know, and if they know, why would they do that? And expose themselves like that. And if they thought it was something else was going on, what did they think was going on? Who wanted them to think that something else was going on, and why? And that, to me, is the major project ahead of us.
When in your book, and it's been a while, that I think you cited, because I cite you, so I hope I'm right, that earlier, I mean, way obviously before the 9/11 event itself, and Cheney going back in time, Rumsfeld going back in time, but W himself talked about invading Iraq, and this was long before the excuse was offered up by the Saudi Arabians of the attack itself. Now, I'm just crazy enough to want to know, was there any relationships in those conclusions and making off those jump-offs? Because in the rise of the Balkans, when these people, the so-called neocons, begin to fester, and it's amazing. There are people in the Denver radio market that continue to have guys like Bill Kristol on their show and lionize these people. These were the planners. These were the people who did this. These were the people who were the original neocons. These are the guys who claimed they could straighten out the world.
And
they're almost like the evil magicians. And how early did you? And this has been a while since I read you, so with apologies. How early did you have Bush talking about that?
Yeah, so you're referring to my book, Family of Secrets, of course, and in there I have at least a chapter. It's been a while since I read it, but talking about, well, one of two different issues. One is that George W. Bush, when he was running for president in 1999, a book was produced with his name on it, and he was supposedly the author of it, which sort of laid out some things about himself and what he wanted to do and so forth. And in the course of doing the book, he worked with a ghostwriter, a very well-respected journalist named Mickey Herskowitz. Mm-hmm. And Mickey, of course, recorded and took notes on their conversations, and he had those notes. They pulled him off of the book project because Bush's handlers were mortified by what Bush had told him. And one of the things that he had told him that was that if he was president, he hoped to invade Iraq.
Yeah, well, I know. I mean, that's where I read that. I read it in your book, I thought.
Yeah, you have a good memory. Yeah. And the reason, supposedly, Mickey was sort of astonished. He said, well, why do you want to do that? And Bush, I guess, was just, he was always a kind of a very, oddly relaxed fellow in certain ways. And he said to Mickey, he said, I'll tell you something that's kind of critical, really, to a president. He said that when my father, George H.W. Bush, was president, it became very, very clear that if you wanted to have a successful presidency or be like Margaret Thatcher and so forth,
Ronald Reagan,
you needed to have a war. In other words, you needed to be seen as a commander-in-chief. And, of course, if you look at our various presidents, I don't know if you'd say that Bill Clinton, launched us into a long conflict, but certainly he was involved with Kosovo and big responses to the coal and so forth, certainly attacks and missile attacks and what have you. And Obama, who has gotten us into a number of new wars along with his friend Hillary Clinton, Libya, Syria, and so forth, he also had that various military operations, like you may remember the rescue of the aid worker who was being held in Somalia. They also, of course, had the Osama bin Laden raid. Mm-hmm. So he was able to kind of earn his stripes. Sure. And this is not George W. Bush being nuts. This is George W. Bush being eminently practical, and he's saying, you have to do this stuff. The public expects this from you. And he said, well, it's okay. I'll do it, and I'll do Iraq, because he felt there was unfinished business there. I think that's a true story. Now, what you're talking about, Peter, which is something else, is about the Cheneys and the
Wolfowitz's, Rumsfeld, Crystal. And
these are a different. These are a different kind of person than George W.
They're
more in a way, a combination of his father, George H.W., and then people who are much more reckless than the father was. And this is empire, folks. This is what we're
absolutely
looking at, empire.
Absolutely.
That's really what it comes down
absolutely
to. And I agree with you that somewhere in this whole mix, it's not possible. I'll tell you something else.
Please, Russ, hang on. And I have two questions I want to ask you to come back that I ask people that I respect. And I got to take the turnaround. Can you stay with me through one more break?
Yeah, sure.
Hang on. Russ Baker's with us. The 28 pages came down, but they have been suppressed again. This should show you what a tremendous insight it is to the Bush-Obama accident.
When you're a kid, monsters live.
Back to the Peter Boyle Show.
This one makes all the sense in the world after watching the Democrats last night in Philly. Everybody was kung fu fighting. But not according to CNN. Kung fu fighting. It's Tuesday, the 26th morning of July, 2016. Good old 710 KNUS. We are Denver's talk station. Hot day. It's going to be 95 today, 97 Wednesday, 95 on Thursday. Our guest is somebody I have immense respect for, Russ Baker. I've read his work. The 9/11 pages that we talked about for so long were released when I was gone, and I came home and sat down and said, I'm going to read these 28 pages. And they are nothing more than marked up again with big black pens. They're called redactions. We still know very little, but at least in some ways, I can see a little bit of a clearer picture in what, in fact, happened, the role of the Saudi Arabians, particularly Saudi ambassador to the United States, Bandar bin Salman, a.k.a. Bandar Bush, and other members of the royal family. Our guest is one of the best. Russ Baker is with us. Russ's website is whowhatwhy.org, and I'm a big fan. I read it every day. Let me ask you a question that I sort of ginned up, and I ask people that I respect, and you certainly are there. The United States of America captures Saddam Hussein, pull him out of a spider hole. Why wasn't he brought back to the United States or to Guantanamo and put on trial like Nuremberg for crimes against humanity? Why? The United States had him. Number two.
Yeah, well,
I'll start with that one. One
of the problems they had was that at the beginning of his career, when he was a mid-level Army officer, he was provided with an apartment and with financial means and support so that he could mount a coup in Iraq, and that was by the United States. And so you could imagine, were he ever put into a court, he would talk about that kind of thing. And he would talk about the role that the United States played in fostering and continuing and exacerbating the horrendous Iran-Iraq war, supplying him with chemical weapons. He would talk about that famous picture of Rumsfeld there shaking hands with him. And so they wouldn't want to talk about those things.
And also we'll talk about there were no WMDs and there were no terrorist camps. That, if you put him on trial in a Nuremberg situation, the other one is, and this has nothing to do with the Navy SEALs. They were sent to do what they were sent to do. But they also could have captured Osama and brought him back and put him on trial.
Yes. And Peter, by the way, you know that as far as Osama goes, Who, What, Why, our site was practically alone among news organizations in raising questions about that operation. Mm-hmm. What happened? First of all, they could have captured him. And even what they say they did doesn't even make any sense. The story that they quickly threw his body in the ocean, that they wouldn't release photos of the body, even though we've seen photos of Saddam and Gaddafi and so on, none of it even adds up. So that's a separate element, but I agree with you that certainly we ought to ask why he was not brought back.
Yeah, but you have the two of them. These are the axis of evil. And they did not want Saddam Hussein, as they say, sitting on the stand as a songbird, because he could have taken this government into such a bad place. He could have spoken to them. And we know now that, you know, during the Iran-Iraq war, the AWACS were picking targets for Saddam. We know the roles the United States played with Saddam Hussein, but principally, I think, they were afraid that he would have himself a couple of great lawyers, and they would say, look, this guy had nothing to do with 9/11. But the same thing is true, and I think it does tie into the Saudi ties to the 9/11 that are detailed in those documents that were suppressed since 2002. Put Osama on trial, and he directly links into the royal families of Saudi Arabia. Wonder what that man would have said.
Well, that's right. But you see, then you would be getting to a narrative and an analysis so powerful and so disturbing that it would force all of us to take stock of what our country is or what our country has done. Not about us as individuals, but we are the most propagandized people practically on earth. Yeah. And we are constantly told, you know, it's like a kid who's parent doesn't know how to raise them. He's just constantly telling the kid how great they are and that everything they do is just amazing. And it's not good for the kid. And this country is like that. And if you watch the recently concluded Republican convention or any of the past Republican conventions, it's all about, you know, it's always this thing about, aren't we just the best? Don't we just do everything great? And of course, you know, that's not healthy. I don't do that with myself. I don't think families ought to have that kind of a dynamic. You have to have candor about what works and what doesn't work, but that's not the way this system operates. So, and the great mass of Americans don't understand much, I'm afraid, of how things do operate, and they don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, I agree.
It's upsetting.
Some of the biggest uphill slugs that I've had began 10, 12 years ago in radio shows when I said there were no WMDs. There were no terrorist camps. There was no ties between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. You would have thought I ran over their children with my car. And now, incrementally, years have gone by, and people have come to the conclusion that W. and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and the entire cabal lied the United States into a war that sets off everything and anything we have today. The insanity of ISIS is George Bush's Frankenstein. Do you believe that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's one more piece of this on our site. I'd love you to take a look at it, whowhatwhy.org. We interviewed former NATO commander Wesley Clark, and he described how right after 9/11 he was at the Pentagon, and he was shown a top-secret document that was already ready
yes,
to go
before 9/11. I read that.
And
yes.
It listed the countries that the U.S. was already planning to invade
yes.
once an excuse presented itself.
Yes, I saw that piece. Come back in 2 weeks. Let's do it again. You're missed on the show. Thank you for everything you've done, and thank you for being so much a part of what we do, and thanks for a home run again, Russ. The website is whowhatwhy.org, and I'm looking forward to the Kennedy book, brother. Take care. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right. 303-696-1971. 710 KNUS Denver's talk station, Jack Cascio coming up. Last night, Michelle Obama talked about President Barack Obama's citizenship. Did you catch it? Front Range Preventive Imaging, we say this all the time, knowing your cholesterol scores and passing stress tests are wonderful. That's a smart thing to do. Knowing your calcium scores with an EBT heart scan can save your life. Do it all. I mean, I do that. You do the stress test. You do your cholesterol numbers. Do it every couple months. Stress test you do once or twice a year. But knowing your calcium score, you do it once a year, and it can save your life. Front Range Preventive Imaging, they also do virtual colonoscopies. They're the gold standard in coronary prevention. 3 times more accurate than other heart scans. Takes less than 15 minutes. Keep your clothes on. Nationally acknowledged as the best indicator of heart disease. Men over 40, please, 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 please do this. Women over 50, please, please, please do this. Take your family. No doctor referrals are needed. Dr. Blanchette runs this. I'm telling you right now, 303-443-7226, 303-443-SCAN. Before fall gets here, get it done. 303-443-SCAN. Front Range Preventive Imaging is in Boulder, Colorado.